Found it in our database. You found it in my personal database, Barclay corrected him. I found the template in your personal database. I extracted Data's files to recreate them here so I could study them. I asked you to join me because I have a number of questions I believe you might be able to help me answer.
Questions?
Barclay shook his head in rapid disbelief. I didn't create the holodeck program from which you surgically removed this file for you or anyone else. I wasn't aboard the Enterprise when they encountered Shinzon at Romulus. I never had the opportunity to say goodbye to him. This program exists because I needed to do that. I needed closure, and this was the only way for me to get it.
Reg, I'm so sorry.
I know I should have deleted it, but I couldn't. It was too hard. It was like killing him again. But I haven't run this program in almost 3 years. It was never meant to keep him alive, and certainly not for anyone else to use it to study him. Countless analyses of Data exist in Starfleet's records. Commander Bruce Maddox has done the most extensive work to date. If you have questions, you should contact him to satisfy your curiosity.
Please, Reg, I had no idea you would react this way, the doctor said softly. I've been consumed by a new case for the last few weeks. One of our officers is suffering from a debilitating terminal illness. We had hoped the cure might lie in stem cell therapy. As of now, that door is closed to us and her condition is deteriorating rapidly. It occurred to me that if we aren't able to reverse it quite soon, that when the time comes, we might be able to temporarily transfer her neural pattern to a holographic buffer. When I was going through the files, I found your program and inspiration struck. Perhaps a neural pattern could be stored indefinitely in a positronic brain. Enterprise's logs indicate that a Dr. Graves once transferred his consciousness into Data, so it is possible.
Barclay couldn't help it. An incredulous laugh escaped his lips before he could think better of it. The doctor blanched, clearly offended. I wouldn't use that lunatic's work as the basis for any serious inquiry. I have no idea how Graves did what he did and no intention of helping you figure it out.
But,
and even if I were so inclined, you're forgetting the much harder preliminary step, creating a new functional positronic brain. That's something even Data could never perfectly reproduce, and he was Data. Watching him try and fail with his daughter, Lal, was excruciating.
I understand it might be challenging, Reg, but this is what we do. Past failures are not certain indication of future possibilities. If we worked together, imagine what we might learn and achieve in the process.
I would never, Barclay insisted.
Why not?
The doctor demanded.
It's disrespectful.
The doctor did Barclay the credit of seriously considering the notion.
Is it disrespectful to recreate Socrates and ask him to demonstrate his method? Or to recreate Shakespeare to discuss the pitfalls of iambic pentameter?
Barclay stepped back. The shock was wearing off slowly, giving way to the same dull misery he remembered experiencing so frequently in the first few months after he had learned of Data's death.
No, but...
But what? I am trying to solve one of the most difficult medical issues I have ever faced, and Commander Data might hold the key to saving a life.
If recreating a functional positronic brain is the only solution, your patient is going to die.
But if I can prevent that...
Who are you?
Barclay bellowed.
I understand doing everything within your power to cure an illness or prolong a life. But sometimes you can't. Sometimes people die. Is it your intention to create positronic brains for all of the fleet's crew? Who decides who might get to use one of these medical marvels and who doesn't? Never mind the fact that you would be damning them to an existence I'm not sure any of them would appreciate. They might live longer, they might live forever. But you cannot possibly believe that the life of an individual stored in an android's body, no matter how advanced, can compare favorably to human existence. I knew Data. Data was my friend. He wanted to be human. In some of the most important ways, he was, even though he would probably deny that statement. But I guarantee you that if he were here right now, he'd tell you to stop. And since he can't, I'm telling you to stop. Don't do this.
The doctor shook his head slowly, his disappointment clear.
I assumed you, of all people, would understand the need, would see what I'm trying to do here.
I don't know what that means, me of all people. We've known each other for many years, and in all that time, you've never intentionally insulted me. I know that wasn't your goal, but you just did. The doctor rested his back against the biobed and crossed his arms.
I apologize.
There has to be another way, Doctor. And if you need me, of course I'll try to help you find it. But you and I aren't going to create a new positronic brain out here with the limited resources at our disposal. What was wrong with your initial thought? A temporary holomatrix? The doctor shrugged.
Processing power, he replied. The last time we did it, we had to pull space from the main computer. We can't do that safely on Galen. She's too small.
Yet, Barclay said. We can't do it yet. Give me some time.
The doctor nodded.
4. Vesta.
81. 82.
The proximity sensor outside Commander Malcolm Roach's door chimed.
83. 84.
Come in,
Roach called between sit-ups. Lying on the deck at the foot of his bed, Roach attacked the remainder of the set with extra vigor as a pair of black boots beneath black uniform pants stepped into view.
Oh, I'm sorry to disturb you, Commander,
the voice of Vesta's young chief engineer, Lieutenant Finnegan Bryce, said.
96. 97.
You're not,
Roach insisted, quickly finishing the last three before taking a moment to catch his breath.
No, we can discuss this in the morning, or whenever you have a minute, Bryce said.
Roach rolled quickly to his side and pushed himself up. As soon as he'd regained his feet, he grabbed a tall glass of water he always kept near at hand and took a generous swig.
What's on your mind, Bryce?
Don't worry about it, Commander.
Roach considered the lanky young man. His sandy blonde hair fell just over his ears, too long for the commander's taste. He preferred to keep the sides of his jet-black hair almost buzzed and the top around half an inch in length. Bryce had striking blue eyes. They were one of the first things you noticed about him as they tended toward the intense end of the spectrum. Reticent, reluctant, and ill at ease were not words that usually came to mind in Bryce's presence. As a lieutenant junior grade, he had nearly single-handedly saved the first vessel attached to the Full Circle fleet that Captain Farkas had commanded, the Quirinal. And that minor miracle, followed by a few major ones, had caused Farkas to ask Bryce to serve as chief engineer when it became clear Preston Ganley wasn't going to recover from the injuries he sustained when a group of non-corporeal aliens invaded and nearly destroyed the ship. This was an extraordinary leap for such a young engineer, even a gifted one, but Bryce tended to shrug off any attempt to remind him that his promotion was well-earned. He moved through his duties with assurance, attacked problems with vigor, and maintained a healthy spirit of optimism, even in the darkest of times, while simultaneously remaining low-key and approachable. Roach knew that Bryce was bright as the day was long, and rarely at a loss for words. A few seconds of sizing up his obvious discomfort, combined with the realization that Bryce had never requested access to Roach's personal quarters after hours, left the commander intrigued. Dropping onto the edge of his rack, Roach motioned for Bryce to take the room's only chair opposite him.
Park it, Lieutenant.
Roach had served for more than 2 years as Captain Farkas's first officer, and, as was required by his position, knew every single member of their crew by name and billet. But he tended to keep people at a distance, more than arm's length, whenever possible. He had found as he'd risen through the ranks that this arrangement suited him and the demands of his job. It wasn't that he didn't like people. He just lacked the patience to get to know them well and rarely found cause to. For a second, Bryce looked ready to bolt. He stepped toward the chair, then reconsidered, and assumed a stance somewhere between attention and at ease.
I'm really sorry to bother you, Commander, but I wanted to make a request regarding our upcoming team assignments.
Roach was taken aback. He and Commander Paris had spent the better part of this day beginning to divide the fleet's crews into small exploratory teams that no one was supposed to know about yet. Vesta wouldn't assume orbit around DK-1116 for another 36 hours, and it would be another day at least before the security teams determined whether or not this massive waste of time, at least in Roach's estimation, was going to go forward. But if Bryce was already in a loop of which Roach was unaware, he was also likely aware that as chief engineer of Vesta, he would be assigned to work with the other available chiefs, Galen's Cress Benoit,
Demeter's Garvin Elkins, and the fleet chief, Belana Torres.
Which team are we talking about?
Roach asked. The group of engineers I'll be assigned to once we reach the planet where Seven found that new element.
Those assignments aren't final yet, and more important, no one is supposed to know about them,
Roach said, rising and squaring his shoulders. Roach wasn't the tallest officer in the fleet. Neither was Bryce. Roach compensated by maintaining an exceptional level of physical fitness. Bryce apparently felt no need to do the same. He looked as if a strong wind might take him off his feet. Only his record and a clear inner strength belied that impression.
I know, Commander,
Bryce said. But you know as well as I do that a rumor of 2 weeks of upcoming shore leave makes its way through the fleet at maximum warp.
If that's the case, you'd better hope the advanced survey teams don't find anything hostile down there.
The last sensor scans I saw showed a bunch of plants, Commander.
I think we can take them, should the need arise. So, what's your request?
I'd like you to consider assigning Ensign Icheb to our group, Bryce said. Ensign Icheb was new to the fleet, and over the last few months had been serving as Commander Torres's personal aide. Voyager's chief, Nancy Conlon, had been taken off duty indefinitely. Roach knew that Torres was leaning heavily on the ensign, much to the dismay of the rest of Voyager's engineering staff. Icheb was actually one of the crew members that Paris was considering leaving off the rotation for now.
I'm not sure that's going to be possible. A handful of critical officers will remain on board each of the fleet ships to maintain operational efficiency. And given that Icheb hasn't been with us that long, Commander Paris thinks he'd be an excellent choice for Voyager's engine room.
Bryce's face fell, but he soldiered on. Roach liked that in a fellow officer.
I get that. I really do. And if I were Commander Paris, I might come to the same conclusion. I've spent a great deal of time with Icheb over the last few months. His assistance was critical in determining potential flight paths following Voyager's initial encounter with the Krennim and locating the message buoy she dropped. He was the one who figured out the temporal displacement ratios that allowed us to reintegrate the buoy into our time period, and he gave us the down-and-dirty specs on integrating Borg-inspired temporal shielding into our defense grid in a tenth the time it would have taken me to complete. I'm good at what I do, Commander. Part of what I do now is identify potential and make sure it is utilized to the greatest possible advantage. I know 2 weeks sounds like a lot of time to spend on a single planet, but the advanced specs I've seen of those biodomes are intimidating as hell. Can you imagine building a starship that could last 1,000 years? Forget that. What about a hull plate that could last half that long? Those biodome fields are energy-based and they've been holding steady for 4,000 years. Do you have any idea how many things can happen on a planet, or near a planet, to alter conditions enough over 4,000 years and make technology like that collapse? There's a regenerative component to those fields. I'd bet my life on it. And no one in our fleet except for Seven knows as much about regenerative systems as Icheb. He's critical to the work our team will be undertaking.
Benoit and Elkins aren't exactly slackers, Bryce,
Roach noted.
No, they aren't. In fact, Elkins scares the pants off me.
But he's also been working closely with Icheb over the last few weeks, and I bet if you asked him, he'd second this motion.
It's not going to be up to me. It's going to be up to Commander Paris,
Roach said.
I understand.
I'd suggest requesting Seven spend some time with you on the surface, but she has already asked to remain on Voyager to study the binaries and the debris fields.
There's more than enough work to go around, Bryce agreed.
A new thought struck Roach.
Is this a professional request, Lieutenant, or a personal one?
Bryce responded immediately.
Professional, sir? I would never... I mean...
As he considered the question more fully, the Lieutenant's cheeks reddened ever so slightly.
I don't mean that he's not... But he wouldn't... I mean, I don't know if... Why? Has he said something?
Shit. Bryce.
Forget I asked. I think our team would benefit from his presence, that's all. And if he thought for 1 second I was making this request for any reason other than his obvious abilities...
Roach had heard enough.
I can't make any promises, but I will take this under advisement and raise the issue with Commander Paris.
Do you have to tell him I was the one who asked?
I tend toward honesty in all of my interactions with fellow officers, Bryce, if only because the truth is the easiest thing to remember.
I understand, sir.
But if it makes you feel better, you make a good case. We'll consider it on its merits.
Thank you, sir.
Bryce looked just this side of miserable as he left. Roach remembered being that young. He didn't miss it. Voyager. Lieutenant Kenth Lazarin was sitting alone in the mess hall, halfway into a bowl of gazpacho, when he suddenly realized someone was sitting to his left. A young boy, his jet-black hair hiding most of his face, was bent low over a pad, furiously keying a calculation. More troubling, this boy wasn't seated in Voyager's mess hall. He was seated in a classroom. Lazarin looked to his right. Another young student, this one a girl, her silvery dark hair pulled back into a tight bun. Around her neck was a string of beads, and as she worked her pad with one hand, she absent-mindedly counted each individual bead with the other. Her lips moved without any sound escaping as she talked herself through whatever problem she was attempting to solve. Beyond her, the row continued as far as Lazarin could see. The same was true on the left. Countless rows stood in perfect order in front of him, a sea of standardized desks filled with students engrossed in a complicated mathematical calculation. He didn't need to look behind to know that there was a battalion of children there, too, all of them striving to do more than complete the problem. All of them were united in and defined by the absolute need to find the answer first. The anxiety of that room was nothing Lazarin had ever known. He closed his eyes and tried to visualize the mess hall, the small table at which he had seated himself, and his bowl of soup. When he opened them, Lieutenant Devi Patel had taken the seat across from him. Instantly he understood the source of the strange vision. It was unusual, but not a huge mystery. Lazarin was tired. He had pulled a double operations shift at Chakotay's request, enhancing long-range scans of the system the fleet was now approaching. His guard was down. Otherwise, this odd, deeply personal moment could not have forced its way into his mind. As one of the few Betazoids in the fleet, Lazarin was called upon from time to time to utilize his psionic abilities in first contact situations, but as a rule, he didn't train it on fellow officers, believing that to be a violation of their privacy. The sheer tonnage of expectant anxiety currently animating Patel was rolling off her in waves. In an attempt to clearly identify the emotions overwhelming him, his mind had automatically reached into hers and plucked out a context. He wanted to apologize, but odds were she wasn't even aware he had done it. It certainly hadn't been intentional.
Hi, Devi.
Hi, Kenth. Would you take a look at this for me?
She turned the pad she was holding to face him and slid it across the table until it rested by his free hand. It contained an open file consisting of detailed sensor scans of a large pool of water located on the surface of DK-1116. Despite the official attempts at secrecy, like everyone else on board, Lazarin was well aware of the fleet's new mission and was thrilled with the prospect of a brief respite from the chaos that usually seemed to characterize the Delta Quadrant. He recognized the data, as he had compiled it during Alpha Shift. What he did not understand was Patel's interest in the site, or the intensity it provoked in her.
"Do you see it?" Patel asked.
"I'm not sure. See what?"
"The unique carved stones beneath the surface."
As soon as she had pointed it out, he did.
"Oh, yeah."
"This pool is actually a stepwell."
"I don't know what that is."
"It's a kind of large well carved into deep canyons, but there are no other similar formations in any of the other biodomes. This site is unique, and the formation suggests it might have been created for a special purpose."
"How do you know that?"
"I've been analyzing the sensor feeds all day," Patel said quickly, as if that were a normal thing for her to have done. "This is going to be our team's research site, and I want to get a jump on our analysis."
"So we can spend most of our time when we arrive on the beach relaxing beside that massive freshwater lake in Biodome 10?
Lazarin asked hopefully. Of course not. What's wrong with you?
Nothing, Devi. I just spent 2 shifts compiling data as fast as our sensors could spit it out. Personally, I'm looking forward to the rest and relaxation portion of our mission more than the work. You might want to think about fun ways to reduce stress yourself.
I'm not stressed, she insisted.
Right now, Commander Torres could use you to power the warp reactor.
Devi sat back in her chair, crossing her arms over her chest. Forgive me for wanting to be prepared.
Prepared for what?
We can't screw this up, Lazarin, Patel insisted.
We haven't even arrived at the planet and already we're screwing something up?
We're only going to have a few days to sort this out. This is the strongest potential evidence I've seen of the species that constructed these biodomes. Wells like this sometimes contain water displacement mechanisms. If we can find it, we can drain the well and see what else is down there. Otherwise, we'll be forced to dive in order to search for underground access to the caverns connected to this well. We have to be ready.
Can't we just use EV suits?
They're not the greatest underwater. Regulation dive gear will be easier and quicker, and everyone on our team is certified. Lazarin set his spoon down beside his soup, pushed the pad back toward Devi, and leaned back. He had known Devi for 4 years. They weren't particularly close, but shared a healthy respect for each other's abilities. It was flattering, in a way, that she was seeking out his counsel. But he couldn't shake the sense that she was seeking to exert control over something rapidly slipping through her fingers. Patel's short black hair framed her face closely, giving it the illusion of greater length than width. With her chin tilted down and her eyebrows lifted, her head almost seemed to come to an unnatural point.
I have to be honest with you, Devi. You're freaking me out a little.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to. It's just... I spoke with Commander Paris earlier today. I asked specifically to be assigned to the same away team as you and Ensigns Japel and Vincent.
Why does it matter what away team you're on?
I don't care about the team as much as our research site. I've looked at most of the others, and while there are some intriguing formations, this is the one with the greatest potential for discovery. Every single biodome contains at least one water source, but none of them look like this one. The water lines vary between 0.5 meter and 2 meters below the surface of the pools, but this one is almost 20 meters down.
Maybe it has receded slowly over time.
If it could recede, whatever atmospheric process evaporating it would long ago have rendered it dry without a natural underground source replenishing it. We'll have to wait until we reach the surface to scan for those, but I don't think we're going to find them. I believe this is the well's natural level.
What exactly do you think is down there?
Look at the compositional scans, Patel suggested. Lazarin did so, and immediately saw what had likely piqued her interest. There's more 7 of Ninonium beneath the surface of that well than in any other biodome. The water is hiding in it. We have to figure out how to get to it, Patel insisted.
First of all, we're not calling it that.
You prefer UI79111 6PJ47027000001?
No, but...
We have to call it something. Just tell me what you want to call it, and I'll add it to our mission schedule.
The thing is, a new element is interesting, but this one isn't of any practical use to us. We're probably going to collect as many samples as we can closer to the surface and call it a day, right?
Don't you see that this is our chance? Patel insisted, raising her voice enough to attract a few curious stares from the other officers hurrying through their own dinners. Lazarin liked Patel. She was a devoted scientist and usually quite pleasant to work with. She took her job seriously and was quick to provide expert analysis. But in the 4 years they had served together, he had never seen her like this.
Devi, talk to me. Forget the planet and the biodome and the water levels for a second. Where is this sudden sense of urgency coming from? This isn't a test. You can't fail.
Patel looked away for a moment, then shook her head quickly, as if she had fought and lost a battle with herself. We're never going to have another opportunity like this, she finally said. If this were any other away mission, Kim, Seven, and maybe Commander Torres would be heading down to the surface to analyze the area.
Gwyn might get lucky and get to go along if they wanted to use shuttles rather than the transporters. And if there was a new, intelligent life form there, you might be asked to use your psionic abilities to add to the data collected. But I would be stuck on the bridge collating Seven's data, and whatever we eventually learned would be added to her already brilliant service record. I don't think anyone else has seen this yet. And I'll bet you anything that if they do, we'll be pulled off this site so more senior officers can investigate it. I don't want that to happen. If we do a thorough enough evaluation now, by the time the captain figures out what's really there, we'll still be the best team to do the work. Lazarin leaned forward. He understood. The complex cocktail of emotions he was sensing from Devi had more to do with fear than stress. She was afraid of being overlooked. She knew she could find the right answer, but in a sea of 1,000 students, it didn't matter unless she found it first. In a way, it made sense. Her work on Voyager had been a great deal more interesting, and her responsibilities more defined before Seven had joined the fleet. Lazarin didn't give much thought to personal advancement. It was enough for him to be a member of the Alpha Shift bridge crew. He'd had a few really interesting and terrifying encounters already on this mission, and that was more than enough excitement for the adventurer in him. He'd also been one of the few officers singled out for promotion since the fleet had launched. Until now, he'd never imagined that Devi resented her status, or was withering away as her skills went unnoticed or underutilized. Tired as he was, he wanted to help her, if only to banish the specter of that sea of unhappy children and their math problems.
"You're probably right," he finally conceded. "This is a rare moment for us. And I promise you, as soon as I've had a few hours of sleep, I'll make sure that our scans tomorrow give us better resolution of this... what did you call it?"
"Stepwell."
"Okay. Got it."
A number of ancient Earth civilizations utilized them. It's weird to see something so similar here. Many of the ones we know about conceal vast networks of tunnels carved into the surrounding rocks. Their purpose was often ceremonial, but I have no idea if that's what we're seeing here. Lazarin smiled gently.
"Don't worry. We'll find out together."
After a moment, Patel returned his smile ever so faintly. "Good." Michael Owen Paris slept soundly in his mother's arms, despite the scene currently underway in his family's living room. B'Elanna Torres had once replicated an antique television set for her husband, Tom Paris. Most evenings, the entire Paris family could be found seated before it, sharing popcorn and marveling at what passed for entertainment a few hundred years ago. Not tonight. The television and all the rest of the room's furnishings had all been shoved unceremoniously against the bulkheads to make room for a Starfleet-issue, self-constructing, domical surface shelter. When B'Elanna and her father had gone camping with her cousins in summers long past, their tents had been smaller and harder to build. Tom had decided this should be a learning experience for their 4-year-old daughter, Miral, so he had deactivated the autonomous setup protocol, removed the spring poles and guide ropes, and was attempting to show his daughter how to construct a tent without the aid of modern technology. Torres wanted to take Michael to his crib and join Tom and Miral on the floor. But she was enjoying watching Tom too much as he tried to extricate himself from the mess he'd made. Miral was proving to be a quick study with the spring-loaded poles.
"Look out, Daddy,"
she warned, as she pressed the small release at the base of a pole and watched it double in length with a loud, satisfying snap. The first time she had discovered this capability, the pole had snapped open into Tom's midsection. Miral had appeared momentarily stricken at the sight of her father's pain, but her concern quickly morphed into peals of delighted laughter. Tom was underneath the silver fabric, careening about as he searched for the slits from which he had removed the poles. His mumbled, frustrated monologue was only half-audible. The half-Torres couldn't hear was probably unsuitable for their children's ears.
"Now where the... I just had it. Hang on, hang on! Okay, Miral, call off the dogs. I found it, honey."
Tom's head poked out through the entrance flap.
"Hand me that pole, sweetie, and come here."
Miral did as she had been instructed,
disappearing underneath the tent with her father.
Where are the dogs, Daddy?
What?
You said there were dogs in here.
No, that was just an expression. Here you go. Put that pole in this opening and...
A distinct ripping sound paused his instructions.
Oh, come on,
Paris said, clearly frustrated. Torres stifled her laughter, placing a hand firmly over her mouth.
What happened, Daddy? Are you okay?
The moment Tom had laid eyes on Biodome 10, he had decided that as much time as duty would allow was going to be spent with his family, camping beside that large lake. The water was unusually still, excellent for giving Miral her first swimming lessons. A forest, for want of a better word, wrapped around the northern edge of the lake and continued for several miles. The growths weren't made of wood. They were soft metal. Numerous bands were braided together in thick trunks, and some of them extended as high as 20 meters in the air. Thinner, branch-like extensions burst from the tops, bending gracefully and providing minimal shade. The place beckoned to the explorer in both of them, and Miral was over the moon at the thought of the days to come. The nights were going to get pretty cold, however, if Tom insisted on building their tent rather than relying on the genius of the Starfleet officers who had gone before him.
"I'm going to replicate sleeping bags for all of us," Torres said.
"Make mine purple, Mommy,"
Miral commanded from beneath the tent.
"I can do that."
"And make Michael's yellow."
"But you hate yellow. What makes you think he will like it?"
Tom asked.
"He can have the yellow so I don't have to."
"Do you think he likes yellow?"
"He likes bananas."
At this, Torres's heart broke a little. For most of Miral's young life, she had been unable to properly pronounce banana, instead calling them ganana or buganana. That little Miralism, along with 100 others, was vanishing as her language skills increased daily.
"He's not old enough to like bananas, honey."
"He will like them. Can I give him a banana?"
"Not for another few months," Torres said. "For now, he just needs milk. And he doesn't need his own sleeping bag."
"Hang on, is this the ground sheet?"
Tom asked. The door chime sounded, and Torres rose from the sofa and moved to open the door manually. Miral had recently discovered the floor sensors inside and outside the door, and had almost broken the mechanism standing with one foot on each side, so Torres had deactivated it, hoping her daughter would soon lose interest in the game. Icheb stood in the hallway, and Torres greeted him cheerfully, hoping to make up a little for her testiness that morning. While reviewing his reports, she had learned that, to his credit, his theory about Vesta's replicator had been proven right.
"Good evening, Commander."
"Come on in, Icheb. Good catch, by the way, with that lot of gel packs."
"Thank you, Commander."
After a pause that threatened to become uncomfortable, he asked,
"I don't wish to upset you, but many of our engineers are wondering if there is any word on Lieutenant Conlon's status."
Torres bowed her head and inhaled deeply. For a few brief hours, she'd managed to forget that one of her closest friends had almost died the previous day. At least she knew. How frustrating must it be for those who cared about Conlon, but weren't part of the small group that received regular updates. "Yesterday was a bad day," Torres finally said. "She pulled through, but it's going to be several weeks at least before we have a new prognosis."
"And before we see her again?"
"Most likely." Icheb nodded.
"I understand. Thank you for telling me."
"Of course. I'll make an announcement tomorrow. And the next time I see her, I'll make sure she knows that everyone is pulling for her." Despite the implied dismissal, Icheb remained rooted where he stood. "Was there something else?"
Commander Paris wished to see me."
"Oh, sure. Tom, Icheb is here." A loud rustling was followed by the emergence of her husband from the folds of silver fabric.
"Hey, Icheb."
"Sir?"
Several minutes of fabric friction had left Tom's fine, light brown hair standing on end.
Icheb pretended not to notice. That's a good look for you, honey, Torres said before heading toward Michael's bedroom.
Can I be of any assistance? She heard Icheb ask.
Miral clearly remained under the silver mess of the tent and could be heard lurching around, randomly calling out,
Here, puppy! Here, puppy, puppy!
No thanks. I've got it,
Paris said, though nothing could have been further from the truth in his wife's opinion. Torres returned, her arms empty, and set about retrieving the poles Miral had stacked in a small cord and carried them under the fabric. Tom and Icheb's conversation was muffled as Torres set to work. After convincing Miral to sit in the center of the ground sheet holding the poles, she spread the rest of the fabric out, quickly located the pole slits, and threaded the poles back into them. She untangled the guide ropes and had Miral carry them out the front opening, which was now discernible, if not fully extended. Finally, she located the auto-construct mechanism over the door flap and reactivated it. Instructing Miral to stand back, Torres allowed her to depress the remote activator and, with a crack, the domical tent snapped to full extension. Miral gave her mother an enthusiastic round of applause and a tight squeeze around the knees before rushing into what would likely be her quarters until they reached DK-1116.
What the?
Paris asked. He stood before the perfect tent, hands on his hips. You're welcome, his wife said.
I was going to finish that.
And now you don't have to. You can get right to the playing in it. Just promise me no campfires until we're on the surface.
Daddy, can we pull the TV in here?
Miral asked from inside. Paris shrugged.
Can we?
Sure. Hey, what did you need with Icheb?
Nothing. Roach advised me that one of his officers requested Icheb for their exploratory team, but I confirmed he's going to have the majority of alpha shifts in Voyager's engine room while we're in orbit.
Torres nodded. She had privately planned to make sure Icheb got a few days' rest on the surface, but without Nancy, that was going to be hard to do. Hard, but not impossible. Honey, did Roach mention who made the request?
Bryce, I think? He wanted Icheb to join the team of engineers studying the biodome field generators.
Bryce?
Yeah?
Torres playfully smacked the side of Tom's head.
Hey!
Why didn't you tell me it was Bryce?
Because who cares?
First thing in the morning, you let Roach know that Icheb will be assigned to that team. I'll cover the engine room while you're on rotation, and we'll still spend the evenings and off shifts camping with the kids.
Why in the world would you do that? You need a break as much as any of us.
I'm going to get plenty of time off. But this is a big deal for Icheb. I should have thought of it myself. Paris pondered his wife for a few silent moments.
You're not playing matchmaker again, are you?
Bryce asked. I'm just approving the request.
That's my job.
What's yours is mine, my love. It was in the fine print when we got married. Paris opted not to argue with that. 5. Vesta. Captain Regina Farkas paused briefly at the entrance to Vesta's medical bay. Gamma shift was well underway, and both she and her CMO, Dr. Elnor Sal, should have been sleeping. That Elnor wasn't meant trouble, and while Farkas would gladly travel from one end of the galaxy to the other in an EV suit for her oldest and dearest friend, the captain had absorbed more than her own fair share of awful since assuming command of Vesta and her short-lived predecessor, Quirinal. She wasn't sure she was up for one of Elnor's moods tonight. Not that she had a choice. Sal would have traveled from one end of the galaxy to the other for her in an EV suit filled with fire ants. And according to her duty logs, Sal was currently getting by on less than 3 hours sleep per day. In Farkas's experience, this was a recipe for disaster. The captain found Sal hunched over one of the lab's data terminals. The other Gamma Shift medics were clearly giving her a wide berth and conducted their work in hushed tones, despite the fact that there were no patients present. Taking the bull by the horns, Farkas moved to Sal's side. Last call was a few hours ago, she said softly. Sal didn't tear her eyes away from the display, but replied,
It's okay. The owner is an old friend of mine.
You know, the only person on this ship who needs her beauty sleep more than I do is you. Sal chuckled grimly and rubbed her eyes.
I'm afraid that ship has sailed for both of us, Regina.
A genetic analysis ran down the screen Sal was studying. A single word caught Farkas's eye. Creosian. The captain's stomach lurched.
It might mean nothing.
Or it might mean that the doctor was inexplicably courting demons laid to rest 30 years ago.
I've got a sciences briefing on the planet we're about to explore at 0700, Farkas said. I have reason to believe that some fairly challenging math will be involved, and I really want to be at my best.
Sal turned toward Farkas.
I have a patient I'm not going to be able to save.
Farkas placed a hand on Sal's shoulder.
I'm so sorry, Elnor.
I hate my job, the doctor said.
It's still not too late to throw 60-some-odd years of experience out the window and enter the command track. You could have my job.
Your job is the only one on this ship that is worse than mine.
Yeah, but think of the perks. For instance, I get to order you to take better care of yourself. Get some rest. Now.
Sal looked at her data screen and reached over to shut off the display. Turning back to Farkas, she said,
In the last few weeks, I've bent, spindled, and done everything short of mutilating my Hippocratic oath to get my patient to agree to the one procedure that might help her. But for a lot of reasons I can't go into, that door is closed. I have to find another option, and I have. But you're not going to like it.
Farkas knew what was coming next.
Did you know there is a half-Creosian female on Voyager?
Sal asked.
I didn't. I suppose the odds were pretty good in a fleet this size. I bet we had a few more before we lost those other 5 ships.
Do you think if we ask the Creosians one more time?
Sal began.
No.
It's been decades, Regina. Most of the folks who were there back then have probably retired by now. Their successors might see things differently. They might at least talk to me.
We barely made it off that planet with our careers intact, Elnor. Just hand over your pips now.
You stir up that hornet's nest again, that's how the story will end. I'm trying to save a life.
And what, pray tell, do the good people of Creos have to do with that?
You and I both know at least part of the truth. We know what they hid from the Federation when they joined. We know what they are capable of.
No, we don't,
Farkas said, her voice and her ire rising.
We know the story of one troubled woman.
She wasn't crazy, Regina.
She was at the end.
That wasn't her fault.
Why are we relitigating this 30 years later in the middle of the damn night? We tried to help her. Against my better judgment and most of the words in the oath I swore to Starfleet, we gave it our best shot, and we failed. I took responsibility for that because I was the senior officer. Along the way, unless my memory is faulty, which it isn't yet, we almost lost the Federation one of their most important members. We aren't responsible for the sins of the Creosians' past any more than we are responsible for the merry mess our ancestors almost made of the planet we both call home. We are responsible for the choices we make tonight and tomorrow and the day after that. So help me, I won't allow you to pick up that tattered flag and start waving it around, when all it will most likely do is bring the full weight of the uniform code down on both our heads.
I just need a few thousand cells.
You said she's only half Creosian.
They're there.
Not according to Starfleet Medical or the Creosian Science Ward.
You can't stop me from asking her.
No, but I can stop you from repeating rumors that have no basis in fact in order to convince her to part with those cells, which I'm guessing she will be unwilling to do.
Sal picked up a cup of something dark and murky at her station that had long ago grown cold and took a generous sip. She grimaced as it went down, then reared back and threw the cup with all her might. It slammed into the partition separating the terminal from a biobed and bounced off the transparent aluminum, landing on the deck.
Feel better now? Farkas asked.
Not really.
Farkas shook her head, dismayed.
I'm going to have to make this a direct order, aren't I?
Sal lifted a pad from her station. She scrolled through a few documents before finding the one she wanted and handed it to Farkas.
What is this? A paper published by Dr. Dorothy Chen Minata 15 months ago. That was going to be my first guess.
She's not in Starfleet anymore, has her own research facility on Thrux.
She cured Raynaud's syndrome in a 63-year-old human female by successfully reverting a single donated blood cell to an undifferentiated state, correcting the regulatory sequence that governs C27A, making a few million copies and delivering those copies directly to the woman's bone marrow. Once there, the cells made some friends, shared some data, and corrected an error that has killed thousands in the last 50 years. Do you know why that's amazing?
You know damn well I don't.
Because it is one of a handful of occasions in the last several hundred years of gene therapy when reversion of an adult cell to an undifferentiated state resulted in a vector that was malleable enough to survive the necessary gene editing. We've been able to revert adult cells for a couple hundred years now, but they are typically useless when it comes to modifying damaged DNA. They look like embryonic stem cells, but they don't act like them. Even removing as many of the epigenetic markers as we can identify doesn't solve the problem. Do you know why it worked this time?
Because the donor was Creosian?
Because the donor was Creosian, the patient's sister-in-law. That got them around the cultural restrictions regarding tissue donation. Chen Minata doesn't come right out and say that the blood cell in question was metamorphic. The Creosians would have silenced her had she mentioned the alterations to chromosome 17 that I'd bet my life and yours were present. Maybe she honestly had no idea why the cell was so easy to manipulate, or she had to play by their rules to get this published and save lives. Either way, it's all the cover I need.
You believe you can do the same here?
I just need an ensign to give me some blood. If she's carrying the mutation, we're in business.
Even if she were willing to overlook her people's cultural taboos, you can't genetically modify her cells and inject them into someone else.
I can if she gives me permission. And according to her file, she is unaffiliated. For all I know, she doesn't give a damn about her people's quasi-religious bugaboos.
Elnor!
If there was another way, Regina, don't you think I would be using it? This mutation is already killing my patient slowly and incredibly painfully.
All you're asking for is a blood sample?
Sal nodded. I'm pretty sure I can incite the necessary changes to the cells once they are extracted. From that point on, I follow Dr. Chen Minata's protocol to the letter.
Farkas sighed. She didn't know if she believed Elnor, or if she just wanted to believe her.
No one else ever has to know, Sal insisted.
What about the other fleet doctors?
Unless I point out the variation, they'd never begin to know where to look for it.
We're trying to cure a unique mutation. This therapy isn't going to have widespread applications beyond curing this one patient. Promise me.
I promise.
Farkas suddenly realized she had lost the argument before it started. By the time she had returned to her quarters and settled herself into her rack, sleep was a lost cause.
USS Demeter. During the first year of the Full Circle Fleet's exploration of the Delta Quadrant, Seven had never had cause to board Demeter. She was the smallest of the fleet's experimental mission ships, and the chain of command was unusual for a Starfleet vessel. Commander Liam O'Donnell was the ship's captain, but given that his expertise was botanical genetics, the ship's XO, Lieutenant Commander Atlee Fife, functioned as O'Donnell's de facto captain during tactical engagements. For the first several months of their journey, it was an open question as to whether or not this command structure would work. After a near mutiny by Fife when the ship was captured by the Children of the Storm, that question was answered, just not in the way anyone expected. Rather than ship Fife back to the Alpha Quadrant to stand court-martial, O'Donnell had offered him a second chance. By all accounts, the partnership that now existed between them was stable and incredibly productive. Fife greeted her when she transported aboard at O'Donnell's request, A tall, gangly human male in his late 30s with sandy blonde hair and unusually large brown eyes, he had escorted her to O'Donnell's private lab in companionable silence. While guiding her through a long hall containing a transparent canopy, he noted that this feature, unique to Demeter, was capable of absorbing and storing several different kinds of radiant energy for use in the ship's ongoing botanical experiments.
"Will it be programmed to collect exotic waves created by the binaries?" Seven asked.
"Of course. Commander O'Donnell has already given us a lengthy to-do list pending our arrival. There are a number of experiments he intends to run while we're in orbit."
"I see.
Will you continue your analysis of the biodome where you made your initial discovery when we return?"
"I have asked to remain aboard Voyager for the duration of our mission."
"Why?"
Fife asked, clearly surprised.
"There are a number of interesting features in the binary system I wish to analyze further, and they can best be studied from our astrometrics lab."
"Why don't you tell him the truth, Seven?"
a familiar voice called. At the end of the hall, a stout man in his late 50s stood just outside an open door. Wiry tufts of dark curls, generously flecked with gray, began at his temples and circled the lower third of his otherwise bald pate. His eyes met hers merrily as she approached.
"What truth is that, Commander O'Donnell?" she asked.
"You have even less patience than I do with the idea of these forced team-building exercises,"
O'Donnell clarified. Seven could feel Fife's eyes bulging in her direction. She didn't want to admit to this, but she couldn't deny it either. Chakotay's suggestion of inter-ship cooperation was fine, in theory. She, however, preferred to work alone and was looking forward to several days of uninterrupted analyses. Rather than run the risk of insulting Fife, she settled for replying,
"How can I assist you, Commander O'Donnell?"
"Thank you, Atlee,"
O'Donnell said with a knowing smile, as he gestured for Seven to precede him into the lab. The space was large for any single officer aboard a ship Demeter's size. Three long diagnostic stations occupied the center of the lab. Their contents were meticulously arranged and banked by operations panels. At the far end of the lab, a large workstation stood beneath a long port with a stunning forward view. Seven guessed the lab was situated just below the ship's bridge. Without further preamble, O'Donnell invited her to the nearest diagnostic station and called up an analysis of a sample of the construct she had taken while on the surface of DK-1116.
"I thought you might want to take a look at this before I go any further, Seven."
At first blush, there was nothing surprising in the data. A handful of atoms of the new element were present, reinforced by several more common stable elements and isotopes. Whether or not these elements were responsible for the unexpected stability of the Seven of Nanonium was, as yet, unclear. Chemists had discovered a few unexpected islands of stability as they had added to the periodic table over the centuries, but Seven's discovery was well outside any previous theoretical bounds. It was the final data set that caught her eye, however.
"A fossilized helix?" she asked.
"A partial, fossilized, double helix," he confirmed.
"But not DNA?"
"Strictly speaking, no,"
he agreed.
"Until I'm on site and can be certain this isn't simply a case of cross-contamination by a nearby life form, I can't be certain of the significance of this finding. But the gross structure of this find is incredibly provocative."
4,000 years, give or take, should not be sufficient time for genetic material to have decayed this much," she noted.
"Were we looking at a living thing, I would agree with you. But we aren't, are we?"
"I don't believe so."
"Look at this,"
he said, magnifying a section of the sample shaped similarly to a brick wall.
"What are these?" Seven asked.
"I don't know. I just know what they resemble most other places we find them in nature."
"Cell walls?"
"I'd say so."
"Is this where you found your fossil?"
"It is."
"Is it your hypothesis, then, that we are looking at a life form?"
"I'm not sure I'd go that far."
Seven turned to face O'Donnell.
"Explain."
"Whatever this is, I don't believe for one second that it is a naturally occurring organic life form.
But every single one of those biodomes is lacking evidence, at least on the surface, of any technology that could have created the structures containing your new element. And there is almost no way it simply arose on this planet.
As far as we know, she insisted.
Granted, but you have to admit we would have been far more likely to have discovered it in a black hole or subspace permutation than here, sitting on this uninhabitable planet and stable. This and the constructs that contain it have to be as synthetic as the biodomes.
These structures could have been created on starships and brought to the surface.
Also possible, but not likely. Biodome 10 contains acres of constructs surrounding that water source. That's a lot of weight for a starship to carry. And even if it did, why just leave it here?
I'm not sure what you're getting at.
I'm trying to understand the purpose of these constructs as suggested by their design, and how they ended up where they are.
They might be merely ornamental, Seven suggested.
Their subjectively pleasant physical arrangement aside,
O'Donnell said,
vast sections of them are composed of this box-like structure similar to a plant cell. They're relatively large, and it's possible they grow by expanding rather than multiplying.
Plant cells that grow in this fashion absorb nutrients. Do you have any theories as to what might serve as a food source?
There's plenty of exotic radiant energy hitting that planet from the binaries.
Have you considered the possibility, Commander, that as this is your particular area of expertise, you are simply seeing what you want to see in this sample? Seven asked.
To a hammer, everything looks like a nail?
He asked, smiling. Something like that.
I don't particularly care which conclusions the evidence points to, as long as it is supportable and can be reproduced under multiple discrete experiments.
Nor do I.
What I see here, however, scares me a little.
Why?
In nature, this structure is associated with one thing, the most efficient absorption and conversion of energy possible.
Which would make these what exactly?
Seven asked. Some sort of incredibly advanced matter-energy storage and conversion device. Plants absorb energy in order to grow. They store excess energy until it is needed, at which point it is released. A structure like this could have been designed to store vast amounts of energy for release by growth, or all at once.
As in explosive? You believe these things might be living bombs?
Well, not anymore. Even if these fossils were actually part of the structure and were once nucleic acids, they're dead now, to all intents and purposes. But a long time ago?
Seven considered the readings again for a few more silent moments.
Still think there's nothing really interesting left to discover on the surface of that planet?
He finally asked.
No, but I am willing to leave the collection of further data from the surface in your capable hands, Seven replied. I will continue my own analyses. Perhaps between the two of us we will be able to construct a plausible hypothesis to answer some of these questions.
O'Donnell stared at Seven for a long moment, a faint smile playing over his lips. Finally, he said,
Among your many attributes, I think the one I most admire is your consistency, Seven.
Voyager. Commander Tom Paris found his oldest and best friend, Lieutenant Harry Kim, on the holodeck, beating the living hell out of a punching bag. The sweat dripping from Kim's face suggested he'd been at this a while.
Hi, honey. How was your day?
Paris asked. Kim paused briefly, acknowledged Paris with a slight nod, and continued punching.
Fine.
Paris knew a dismissal when he saw one. He'd first learned how those worked at the hands of his father, the late Admiral Owen Paris. He also knew that Kim had been in 18 different kinds of pain since Nancy Conlon had been diagnosed and transferred to Galen. Paris didn't know the particulars of the illness. He didn't need to. He figured B'Elanna knew more and was probably respecting Conlon's privacy. There was nothing Conlon could have asked of him that Paris wouldn't readily have given to help her. But his focus during this crisis had been, and would always be, Kim's well-being.
Got a second?
Kim released a loud huff and grabbed the bag to still it.
What do you need, Tom? I have good news and I have bad news, so I thought I should deliver it personally,
Why don't we get the bad news out of the way first?
Kim's eyes didn't register trepidation at this pronouncement. That wasn't, in Paris's opinion, a great sign.